D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Heute Moral Relativism von Stephen Lukes. Stephen Lukes ist Professor für Soziologie an der New York University. Er arbeitet auf dem Gebiet der Sozial- und Politikwissenschaften und hat ein Buch veröffentlicht zum Thema Moral Relativism. Andere Kulturen haben eben andere Wertvorstellungen und wir können und sollten darüber nicht urteilen. Das ist, stark vereinfacht, die Position, die man als moralischen Relativismus bezeichnet. Religionen, Länder und auch soziale Klassen haben nicht nur unterschiedliche Traditionen und Gebräuche. Auch das, was geboten und verboten ist, was als richtig und falsch gilt, unterscheidet sich oft stark. Das wird gerade dann deutlich, wenn es um besonders umstrittene Rituale geht, Ehrenmord etwa oder weibliche Genitalverstümmelung. Diese Beispiele diskutiert Stephen Lukes in seinem Vortrag Moral Relativism. Lukes geht in seinem Vortrag der Frage nach, was ganz konkret die Denkschritte sind, die zu der Idee führen, Moral sei relativ. Und Stephen Lukes begründet auch, warum diese Logik nicht immer gültig ist. Hören Sie jetzt Moral Relativism von Stephen Lukes.
I'm going to talk about moral relativism because that's what I was asked to do. And the topic is a hot one in a way. It doesn't go away. It's a topic which is kind of always with us, though it is a contemporary topic, a modern topic, I think. You could think of moral relativism as a condition, of which I'm going to tonight try to offer a diagnosis. Not, however, a cure, though maybe an antidote, or maybe, as I'll try and argue, two alternative antidotes, that's to say, ways of resisting this condition. So I've given you a clue as to where I stand about this. Moral relativism is, to end with this metaphor, it's something which is both attractive and repellent. It attracts some people and it repels others. And part of what I'm going to do when trying to diagnose it is to try to give some sense of understanding of why that is. What is it that makes it so repellent to some and so attractive to others? I mean, just to give a few examples, which I do in the book, the Pope, the present Pope, when he was elected, declared very forcefully that he was going to fight against what he called the dictatorship of moral relativism. It was a big issue for him, doubtless still is. I think I also quote Alan Bloom, who had a great influence in America, wrote a book about the closing of the American mind, about education. For him also, this danger of moral relativism was completely central. And many people write in this way and argue in this way and think that it's something really to be fought and resisted. I, as I've said before, also think we need to resist it, but not in that way. That's to say, I think we need to understand it and figure out what it is that both attracts and repels. As for the attraction, I find when I teach this topic, or teach morality, sociology of morals, which is what interests me, most undergraduates, I have no idea how it is in Germany, maybe you will tell me, but in America, where I teach, the normal general outlook of young people in their late teens, is to think that it's obvious that one should be a relativist about morals. Or at least, as I've discovered, that is the general view. But when you bring up the topic, as I'm going to do in a few moments, of female genital mutilation, you tend to get the response, not that. There are limits. But the idea, in other words, who are we to criticize others? This question is a question which generates this answer. So just to say one thing about why I wrote the book. The book, and indeed my continuing interest in this topic, arises out of the difficulty or the question of how you reconcile two thoughts or two intuitions, which I believe pretty well everybody has. On the one hand, the intuition that something like human rights exist, that's to say, there are ways that people should not be treated, tortured, raped, and so forth, and there are entitlements which they have anywhere on the planet, whoever they may be, wherever they may be placed, whatever society they're living in, that thought. And on the other hand, a different thought, namely the thought that's expressed by the question, well, who are we to criticize others? What's our standing? What gives us the entitlement to make moral judgments about others? So the question that generated the writing of this book and thinking about this topic is how you can put these two thoughts together. So what I want to do now today is first of all tell you what I think moral relativism amounts to, and then to focus, which I feel is important and useful, on three cases, on three examples that are relatively concrete or relatively thick in the sense that they're not just abstract philosophers' thought experiments, but actual real issues or real cases. To focus our minds, I'm proposing that we discuss these three cases or discuss the problem in the light of these three cases. And then I'm going to end up with some suggestions about how to resist the temptations, the attractions of moral relativism by reference or with reference to these three cases, which I think are distinct from one another. So first of all, then, what do I take it to be, moral relativism? Well, it's interesting because, especially when you read philosophers, this is, of course, a big debate, how to define it, and people offer different accounts. And I'm not going to spend time listing or going through these. Let me just try to say as succinctly or briefly as I can what I think this is. I think moral relativism, as I understand it anyway, is a certain progression of thought which goes like this. You observe diversity. That's to say, you observe diversity of practices, beliefs, judgments in different places, different cultures, let's say, that seem to not only be different, but to be even deeply different and to clash, to be diverse in this sense. And to be more specific, this involves different people or different peoples giving alternative and indeed conflicting answers to the question what one ought to do and what is of value and what's good. So you have diverse and even conflicting moral judgments about how people should be treated, what constitutes cruelty, who should be treated with care, who should not, and so forth. So you observe these differences. Then, secondly, having noticed this, seeing the diversity, you then reflect on the fact that these disagreements are not going to be resolved in a way that will be convincing to everybody. That is to say, you notice and reflect on the fact that there is a problem about justification that is a deep one. It's not going to be resolved by appeal to some argument or revelation or basis or foundation that everyone will accept as deciding the matter. And that, by the way, and I'm going to come back to this in a minute, that is, I think, a modern problem. Or at least a problem which is now very present to us in our modern world. So from that observation of the diversity of moral practices and judgments, and the reflection that there's no way of deciding on a fundamental basis that everyone can agree on what the right answer is, you then move to a third stage, which is from your own standpoint, that's to say, you, the person deciding what is the right way to behave or what the right thing to do is, you then conclude, well, there's no way that you can make a judgment that is independent of your own standpoint, of your own moral world. And in particular, you decide you're not in a position to criticize others. What I actually think is that this progression of thought, which is, I'm sure, familiar to everyone here, I presume, this progression of thought is a progress along a road which is full of pitfalls. I mean, it's a progress which I think needs to be resisted. But notice that it's a progress which involves a shift of perspective as you progress. That's to say, you start off as an observer. You notice diversity of morals. You then shift from the observer's perspective to what, let's call it, the philosopher's perspective, or at any rate, a reflective perspective. You ask yourself the question, well, what's the right way? Or rather, what could justify these different standpoints that you've observed? So you're stepping back and asking that question. Let's call that the philosopher's perspective. And then you shift, thirdly, to your own perspective. That's to say, you've moved, so to speak, from a third person to a first person perspective, and you conclude that I, the person now making moral judgments, can't judge others, and can't judge others, or rather can't judge others from any standpoint than that escapes from my own perspective. That in other words, I'm in some way trapped in my own moral point of view. What I've just described, rather abstractly, is what I understand moral relativism to be. It's the move from the observer via reflection to the first person abstinence from making critical judgments that involve stepping outside your own standpoint. Now, one thing I just want to say, by the way, is some people think, and it used to be very common to think this, that moral relativism means tolerance. That's to say, if you go along this progress, if you take this particular journey I've just described, then you're going to end up as a very nice, tolerant person. That isn't necessarily the case. Of course, it might be the case. But the progress doesn't necessarily lead to that outcome. I mean, you can be a very racist, fascistic kind of a person and a moral relativist. I mean, you just decide that your standpoint is the one which you're going to adhere to, and there's no... And indeed, of course, there is a famous philosophical reductio ad absurdum sort of proof to the effect that there's a problem about being a relativist and intolerant anyway, because if you're really a relativist, then the principle of tolerance surely should also be relativized. So how do you justify being tolerant if you're a relativist and so on? But there's another simpler way, I think, of showing that tolerance and relativism don't go together, and it's this, that, I mean, what after all is tolerance? Tolerance is where I have a particular moral view or standpoint, and you are in the way. You're doing things I really disapprove of. And if I'm going to be tolerant, I'm not going to interfere with you. I'm going to sort of abstain from interfering with you while retaining my objections. So a tolerance in religion and in morals actually requires you to have a strong moral view, not to abstain from it, but to abstain from interfering with others whom you continue to criticize as being objectionable. Well, all of this is a bit abstract, so I want to move on to talking about trying to sort of deal with the diagnosis and the suggested antidotes. I want to now just move directly to these three examples because, you know, I don't like talking at too abstract a level about these things. And I've got lots more to say about moral relativism, but I think it'll make more sense and be more interesting, I hope, if we can think about these more abstract questions in the light of these examples. So here they are. Now, I've given them numbers, and I'm going to read them because, first of all, I find it tiresome if someone's giving a talk and then you're expected to read something while the person's talking. It's very irritating. I find that that's my big problem with PowerPoint. So I'm going to read these things because they are actually, in any case, interesting. The three quotations come respectively from an ancient author, from the founder of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta, and thirdly, a recent news report from Reuters news agency. So the first comes from Herodotus, and this is a famous story for those of you who read in this area, but it's such a good story that it bears repeating. So Darius, the great king of Persia, summoned the Greeks, who happened to be present at his court, this is Herodotus writing, and asked them what they would take to eat the dead bodies of their fathers. They replied that they would not do it for any money in the world. Later, in the presence of the Greeks, and through an interpreter, so that they could understand what was said, he asked Darius some Indians of the tribe called Calatii, who do in fact eat their parents' dead bodies, what they would take to burn them. And they uttered a cry of horror and forbade him to mention so dreadful a thing. And I can't avoid or forbear from then including what the philosopher Mary Midgley then added to this story in a little book called Can't We Make Moral Judgments. She made the comment that in this story, the Persian king appears in the role of the detached, sophisticated, neutral observer above the dispute who understands other people's difficulties. He is the one who can see through superficial symbols to the reality behind them. The Persians, after all, neither burned their own dead nor ate them. They knew very well that they had solved the problem of disposal in the only right way, namely by putting corpses on high towers and letting the vultures eat them. Which I think is a very nice comment, because it really does show this clash of perspectives. I mean, it is really very fascinating to see an ancient Greek author observing moral diversity in this way. Classicists tell me this was really quite unusual, and it's interesting that you actually have Herodotus spelling out the same event from different points of view, the same practice, or rather the same. Well, that's the issue. Is it the same? What I think is going on here, and here I'm anticipating what I'm going to say a bit later. But what's going on here is, of course, alternative ways of disposing of the dead, or perhaps better still, alternative ways of honoring the dead. So that's the first example. Second example, this comes from my book, and I was extremely interested to discover this, that Jomo Kenyatta, the founder of the Kenyan nation, was a student of anthropology at the London School of Economics, and his teacher was Bronislaw Malinowski, who wrote the preface to the book he published called Facing Mount Kenya. And in this book, there's a chapter about female circumcision, or as it is widely called, female genital mutilation. Though some people, some contemporary anthropologists, prefer to call it female genital modification. And of course, it matters a lot what you call it. There are three different kinds of it, and the third, or the worst kind, or the most serious kind, has very considerable effects, both in terms of health and in the possibility of sexual pleasure, denying it. So here is what Kenyatta wrote. So he wrote, this book was published in 1938, and he insists in this book that the various sides of Kikuyu life are parts of an integrated culture from which no single part is detachable. Each has its context and is fully understandable only in relation to the whole. This national culture teaches the individual his mental and moral value. His is being used generically here. I mean, his and her. It makes him feel it worthwhile to work and fight for liberty. One essential side of this culture consists in the initiation rites, in particular the custom of clitoridectomy of girls, which is described in vivid and gruesome detail. But executed Kenyatta writes, with the dexterity of a Harley Street surgeon. This ritual has been strongly attacked, wrote Kenyatta, by a good many Europeans who see it as nothing but a horrible and painful practice, he puts this in quotation marks, suitable only to barbarians, whereas, quote, it is the most important custom among the Kikuyu, for these rites are looked upon as giving a boy or a girl the status of manhood or womanhood in the Kikuyu community. Of course, the practice is that is actually described in the chapter is a practice upon girls. And its abolition, Kenyatta wrote, would destroy the tribal symbol which identified the age groups and prevent the Kikuyu from perpetuating that spirit of collectivism and national solidarity which they've been able to maintain from time immemorial. And then I quoted Malinowski, in whose discussion class Kenyatta studied at the LSE, wrote in the introduction to the book that it was a personal statement of the new outlook of a progressive African who presents the facts objectively. Very interesting. Now, that is the second example. And the third one is longer. And if you'll bear with me, I do actually want to read it all, because it's not only extremely well documented and carefully written, but it does bring out a whole series of aspects of this case of honor killing, which I feel are necessary for the discussion of this. This is from a Reuters correspondent about a honor killing in Haryana, Indian state, and there was a recent case actually just reported in the last month, very similar to this, but this actual case goes back to 2008. So, from a town called Bala in Haryana state, five armed men burst into the small room and courtyard at dawn, just as 21-year-old, 22-week pregnant Sunita was drying her face on a towel. They punched and kicked her stomach as she called out for her sleeping boyfriend, Jasa, 22-year-old Jasbir Singh, witnesses said. When he woke, both were dragged into waiting cars, driven away, and strangled. Their bodies, half-stripped, were laid out on the dirt outside Sunita's father's house for all to see, a sign that the family's honor had been restored by her cold-blooded murder. A week later, the village of Bala, just a couple of hours' drive from New Delhi, stands united behind the act, proud, defiant, almost to a man. Among the Jat caste of the conservative Haryana, it is taboo for a man and a woman of the same village to marry. Although the couple were not related, they were seen in this deeply traditional society as brother and sister. From society's point of view, this is a very good thing, said 62-year-old farmer Balwar Arya, sitting smoking at a hookah in the shade of a tree, in a square with other elders from the village, council, or panchayat. We have removed the blot. Growing economic opportunities for young people and lower castes in Haryana have made love marriages more common, experts say, and the violent repression of them has risen in tandem as upper caste Jat men fight to hold on to power, status, and property. Sunita's father, Om Prakash, has confessed to murdering his pregnant daughter and her boyfriend, police told Reuters. An uncle and two cousins were among four others arrested. But in Bala, many people believe the father confessed merely to underline that he supported his daughter's killing to satisfy honor and protect the real culprits among his family or village. At their house, Sunita's mother did not emerge to talk. Instead, a young man on a motorbike tried to intimidate the Reuters team into leaving. It turned out that he was another of the Sunita's cousins, his father and brother held by the police. We're not ashamed of it, absolutely not. We have the honor of doing the village proud, he said. We wouldn't have had a face to show if we'd not done this. It was an act of real men. The relatively prosperous northern state of Haryana is one of India's most conservative when it comes to caste, marriage, and the role of women. Deeply patriarchal caste purity is paramount, and marriages are arranged to sustain the status quo. Men and women are still murdered across the villages of northern India for daring to marry outside their caste. But in Haryana, the practice is widespread and widely supported. Here, women veil their faces and scarves in public. The illegal abortion of female fetuses is common. The ratio of women to men in Haryana is just 861 to 1,000, the lowest in the country. Anyone who transgresses social codes by marrying across caste boundaries or within the same village is liable to meet the same fate as Sunita and Jasbir. Many such murders are never reported. Hardly any result in prosecution, says Professor Javed Alam, chairman of the Indian Council of Social Science Research. People from the same village are treated as siblings in Haryana, he said, so this is all treated as incest. Without any law to prohibit this kind of marriage, the only way you can punish it is by taking the law into your own hands. People believe people who commit incest should be killed.
Nor do politicians ever renounce the practice, Alam added, because if they did, they would not win elections. So this is all connected up with the political system. And the legalization of property rights for women in 1956 made love marriages within a village even more dangerous for this elite, as daughters living close to home could then in theory claim a part of the family land, sociologist Prem Chowdhury said. Sunita and Jasbir, sweethearts in the same class at school, had little chance. When he left school a couple of years before her to become a photographer's apprentice, he would often hang around at the school gates to collect her. She was married off to another man, but left her husband to elope with Jasbir a year and a half ago. And while the families tried to keep them apart, they realized it was a losing battle. They were madly in love even to the last day, said Jasbir's 16-year-old sister-in-law, Lalita, in the house where they had lived in Makrol Village, around 35 kilometers by road from Bala. To make matters worse, Jasbir was from a lower subcaste, and she was pregnant outside marriage. Sunita's parents in Bala found themselves virtually ostracized. Nobody would drink water in our house, Sunita's mother, Roshni, is reported to have said. My daughter's action made us aliens in our own land, but we've managed to redeem our honor. She paid for her ill-gotten action. But among Jasbir's family, split between Makrol and Bala, grief is mixed with fear. Why are you talking to the media? Shouted a female family member at one point. This will only bring more trouble. At the small police post in Bala, a constable admitted the case was unlikely to ever reach prosecution, with the village putting enormous pressure on the police and especially Jasbir's family to quietly drop the case. We're being pressurized into reaching an agreement, a compromise, without even being given time to grieve, said Jasbir's 25-year-old sister Neelam. We've been told that if we don't compromise, we'll suffer the same fate. In the narrow alleyway outside their tiny house, women wailed in grief. A few hundred yards away, the panchayat sat in quiet self-satisfaction. The people who've done this should get an award for it, said 48-year-old Salvir Singh. This was a murder of morality. So, this progression of thought that I talked about, which moral relativism is, on my view, is much more natural, let's say, to engage in. If what you're thinking about can be brought under the heading of custom, convention, and by the way, I don't mean even to say that custom and convention are quite the same, but let's say customary norms, or norms which are practiced in a community as a matter of custom. So what I'm now going to address is this very interesting and, I think, difficult and topic that's worthy of a lot of reflection, which is how should we draw the distinction between custom and morality? Or, as it's said in French, morale and mœurs, or mores, morality and mores. I've been doing a bit of research while at the Wissenschaftskolleg into this, and I can't report anything very, very definite yet, but it does, I mean, the history of these words is very interesting. It may well be that the distinction between morality and mores is actually a relatively modern distinction. A classicist colleague at the Wissenschaftskolleg tells me this was not a distinction which the Greeks made, though they did make the distinction between nature and convention. But specifically, the question is, how do we distinguish between prevailing norms, norms that are just in operation in some given time and place, and what we've come to call morality? Practices of, let's say, greeting, the ways in which people greet each other, or modes of dress, or even cuisine, are practices, norm-governed practices, which vary, of course, from place to place, vastly and widely. And yet the appropriateness of criticizing others for their mode of greeting, let's say, seems entirely pointless. But of course, it's obvious once you start reflecting on this that this is a shifting boundary, or rather, what lies on either side of this boundary shifts across time. Perhaps what I want to say is this, that to the extent to which you think of morality as custom, which, by the way, is the way that anthropologists historically, or traditionally anyway, tend to have thought about it, then what I've called the progression of thought that leads to moral relativism is all the easier to make. And by the way, the great heyday of moral relativism, or as it was then called, cultural relativism, was of course expressed and practiced in a very popular way by anthropologists in the 1930s. And I'm thinking of writers like Margaret Mead and, of course, Ruth Benedict and Melville Herskovitz, who were self-proclaimed relativists. So their motivation was anti-racist. They had a very progressive agenda in mind, but they were very keen to argue that moralities were various, diverse across the world, and that we shouldn't engage in what they thought of as derogatory criticisms of other cultures. So Ruth Benedict, for example, wrote, morality is a convenient term for socially proved habits. And that goes back, that idea, to very early social anthropologist William Graham Sumner, who said, immoral never means anything but contrary to the mores of the time and place. This was almost, in fact still is, a kind of professional inclination of social anthropologists and cultural anthropologists to assimilate the moral to the customary. Not that all social anthropologists do this by any means, but there is something in the nature of that discipline which I think inclines its practitioners to saying this kind of thing. I mean, if we go back to this progression of thought, this moving from the observer's perspective via reflection to the judgment-making of the moral agent, someone who's actually making moral judgments, it seems to me the Herodotus case looks to me like custom. Plainly the question of honoring the dead, honoring your dead ancestors, or honoring your, let's say, your dead parent, is a matter of great significance in human life. It's not a trivial thing. Nor, by the way, the other examples I mentioned, like greeting, that's not trivial either, but this certainly isn't. Yet you could say that these are all variants of a common practice, and there isn't a problem that I can see about saying, well, these are just ways of doing it. These are just different ways of doing it. Of course, what's interesting about the example is that all this emotion is attached to it. I mean, it's the Kalatii and the Greeks were horrified at each other's practice. That's clear. But you could perfectly well see that this would be a case where someone inclined to moral relativism could certainly think, well, here is a customary practice and there are just different variants. So how you bury your dead is something which, your culture will tell you, or your local horizon, your local way of doing things will decide the question. And you could well be horrified at the way others do it, but it's not as though there is a right way to do it, that somehow the morally right way to do it. I'm not expressing my view at this point, I'm just saying how that could be a natural way to think. Now, leaving number two for the moment, just skip over to number three and the Haryana village. I can't imagine that there's anyone in this room who might think similarly about that case. You could there say, well, here we are really in the realm of morality, in which the issue of what goes on here of course, has to be understood, as is very richly described in this text, in its full contextual complexity. I mean, in terms of the relations of power and property. And, you know, I think the text brings out very well how interconnected all this is. But I could imagine few people. I can't imagine anyone I know who would find it easy to say, reading this text, or find it even possible to say, well, that's the way they do things there, and who are we to judge? In other words, here I think the progression I've tried to indicate that moral relativism consists in is a progression that meets with severe blockage. Of course, there's a whole set of other questions which I'm not touching on here. I mean, someone may want to raise it, but the question of what you actually do, I mean, faced with this, is another issue. I mean, how, for example, let's say people working for NGOs, or even, you know, people in India, let's say judges and policemen and so forth, and politicians are to approach this question of this Haryana village, is a whole other question, and probably extreme delicacy and care and indeed dialogue and all of that are going to be necessary even to move, to inch forward on this topic. But the idea that you could do the relativist move, the progression from observation to the conclusion, well, that's the way they do it and who am I to judge, is not, it seems to me, a feasible one. Now, number two, I am inclined to say the same thing, though I don't know whether everyone here will agree. I mean, I do know that there are serious people. I encounter them sometimes. There is, in particular, a very well-known anthropologist, Richard Schwader, at the University of Chicago, who says exactly this, that all this talk about the evils of female circumcision, I mean, he's the one who wants female genital modification as the appropriate term. So I suppose the general question I'm raising is, how do we decide this? How do we know where this progression of thought is appropriate and where it isn't? I mean, it's plain to me, anyway, that it's not appropriate in case three, and it's plain to me it is appropriate in case one. And I would say it's not appropriate in case two. Well, I suppose what I've argued until now is that the progression of thought that I call moral relativism is appropriate where we're not actually talking about morality, but we're talking about custom. I guess that's what I've been saying. But, of course, with the thought that, with the rider, that qualification, that distinction is itself very problematic. And some, as I've said, some people, and in particular those who think that morality is properly to be thought of as a set of social norms, which is what Ruth Benedict used to think. By the way, Ruth Benedict ceased to think it once. I mean, the big challenge to that view of the cultural relativists of the 1930s was the Second World War, where Nazism really did put a big dent into the thought that, you know, each culture its own morality. And of course, in these days, I should maybe have said this, these days there's a problem that all anthropologists face in making this move, in that anthropologists have become very much, very conscious of the mistake of talking about cultures in a holistic way anyway. But that's another discussion. What I've argued up to now anyway is that this progression of thought that is what I think moral relativism is easier to make the more you're inclined to think of morality in this quasi-anthropological way. But I think that we need something a bit more robust in order to resist it, in order to not cure it, but resist it. That's why I talked about antidotes, because after all, antidotes don't always work. Namely, the thought that the second stage of this progress that I talked about, you're moving, you observe moral diversity, then you ask the question, well, how can different moral views be justified? And you conclude they can't be, so you then, you can't justify one view as against another. And so you conclude, well, all I've got is my own view. Now, I think that that second step needs a lot of attention, because I think it's a very modern problem, this problem of justifying our moral standpoint. And that's why I said at the beginning that this problem of moral relativism is a modern sort of condition. Because I don't believe, I could be wrong about this and someone may want to disagree, but I don't believe that this problem of moral relativism really, I don't think it was around before the 19th century. Pascal famously once wrote in one of his Pensées, what's true on one side of the Pyrenees is false on the other, is error on the other. But that didn't lead Pascal for a single moment to doubt his Christian faith. I mean, other things troubled him. I mean, and he certainly, was troubled by doubt and found ways of dealing with that. But the diversity of moral judgments and moral practices was not something that troubled him. And all the way through Western thought, you can find, European thought, you can find writers cataloguing the diversity of moral practices around the world. For instance, Voltaire, in his Essay sur les Mœurs, writing about different moral practices, Voltaire wrote, there's only one morality as there is only one geometry. When they apply themselves to it a little, everybody is in agreement. That's Voltaire. So I think it was only in the 19th century when both faith, religious faith, and rationalist faith, let's say, faith in reason, started to get shaky, that the problem started to emerge in a serious way. And I think it really began seriously to trouble people with Nietzsche, but that's maybe another discussion. At any rate, I think it's certainly been around, as I've suggested, in the 20th century. And so what I propose just to refer to at the end of this talk is the following, that I can see, and this is what I sketchily argue at the end of the book, I can see two routes or two ways of trying to respond to what's sometimes called anti-foundationalism, or the idea that there's no foundation for our moral judgments, that we can offer to ourselves or to others as a way of dealing with the thought that all we've got is our own standpoint, and if it doesn't convince others, well, that's just all there is to say. I don't think that's ever the case, that it's all there is to say. There's always more to say. And I think there are two lines of thought, two ways of trying to respond to this sense of unjustifiable moral positions. For example, about, just to be specific, you know, why were the killers of Sunita in Bala doing something wrong? What was objectionable about this morally? I mean, what was morally not acceptable here? And I would say similarly, what are we to say to someone who, like, say, Richard Schroeder, someone who will say to us, well, you know, female, that's just a ritual practice. It's fine. The women are with it, in favor of it, and the young girls regard it as a means of becoming, you know, accepted, initiated into the community, and that's the way to see it. So what are you going to say? What's sayable that would have any rational force? That's to say, in the form of offering reasons that could justify resisting these defenses. And as I say, I think there are two routes that are promising in this way, in this respect. One is a kind of Kantian route, the sort of line that's taken these days by Jürgen Habermas and by Others, in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, I'm thinking of Tim Scanlon and others, namely the demand that whatever practice it is we're talking about, whether it be honor killing or female circumcision, clitorectomy, or whatever it may be, it is relevant and appropriate to expect that this practice be justifiable to all those affected by the practice, so that it could only be taken to have moral standing if, and here you have to make a few qualifications, if all those affected can accept it as justifiable under conditions in which they are not themselves subject to some kind of fear-inducing power. And that's relevant to the example I gave from Haryana. You remember the rather detailed or rather well-described situation in which the actors are themselves in fear of even speaking to the journalist. So one line out of the problem, or one antidote, I think, is this, let's say, demand for justification. Now, the other line, which is one, in a way, I prefer, but when I say prefer, I think is also strong and worth a lot of attention, is Aristotelian in inspiration. And I'm here thinking of the kind of argument you find in The Economist, in the writings of the economist Amartya Sen and in Martha Nussbaum, who have this idea that, which derives from Aristotle, that there are certain basic preconditions for living a human life. That is to say, a life that in which human beings can function as human beings in a minimally appropriate way, or rather the conditions are minimal conditions for living a human life, but without assuming that there's any one best way of living such a life. That is to say, unlike Aristotle, you need make no assumption here about what the best way to live is, but simply assume that there are certain basic capabilities which any human beings must have, and of course most obvious first in such a list would be adequate nutrition and a reasonable basic minimum of health and so on and so forth. But extending further into, for instance, and I really find this one very impressive, comes from Adam Smith actually, as among the conditions, the capability or the possibility of being able to move about your community without shame, which is one of the, appears on the list. And obviously there, the particular example that Amartya Sen has in mind and Nussbaum is the case of Indian widows in India. In other words, and you can argue, we can argue extensively about these lists and what the list should entail, and whether such a list could indeed be culturally and morally, in some sense, impartial or neutral. That's a big and difficult question. But nevertheless, the idea seems to me to be fundamentally sound, that there are minimal preconditions for living a life that is compatible with our nature as humans. That is another way, I think, of reasoning that will enable one to deal with examples 2 and 3. At any rate, when I say deal with, resist the progression of thought that I've called moral relativism, so I think I'll stop there.
Der Sozialwissenschaftler Stephen Lutz über moralischen Relativismus und seine möglichen Gegengifte.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.